Hello, this is Paula Kaufman with the Herald and Review, dated Thursday, March 9th, 2017. We'll begin today's reading on the front page with an article titled "Islamic Center Welcomes Visitors for International Women's Day" by Teresa Churchill, H&R Senior Writer. Decatur. During a time of uncertainty for Muslims, the visitors pouring into the Greater Decatur Islamic Center on Wednesday evening were a welcome sight. 100 adhesive name tags at the welcome table were gone 20 minutes into the three-hour open house for International Women's Day. Visitors tried on hijabs, got henna tattoos drawn on their hands, sampled some unfamiliar foods, and explored tables with treasures from 10 different countries represented in the local Islamic community. They also left with a new appreciation for people who might be affected by President Trump's latest travel ban, which restricts travel into the United States for 90 days starting March 16th from the Muslim-majority countries of Iran, Libya, Somalia, Syria, Sudan, and Yemen. One of the displays was created by Miriam Mohammed, originally from Somalia, and another by Razia Zabehi and her daughter, Sarah Nazarian. "I am from Iran, and Iranis are not ISIS," Zabehi said. "These are real people's lives," Chris Oyer of Decatur said, after going around the room. "It could just as easily be happening to me and my family." Oyer said her faith background is Mennonite, and that she came to show support for diversity in Decatur. Mohammed said she felt disappointed to lose freedoms in a country where everyone can worship how they choose, but she was delighted to share samples of the lahu, a popular breakfast dish in her home country, she had prepared, and show a few of her dresses, examples of Somali darak. Among the myths the women of the Islamic Center said they hoped to dispel is the notion that the hijab is a sign of second-class citizenship, when it actually frees women from society's tendency to objectify them. Farah Mahmoud showed Shai Gettenbacher how to put one on after her mom, Kim Gettenbacher, finished giving Mahmoud a big hug. "We've been friends for 15 or 20 years," said Kim, who is a member of Holy Family Catholic Church. Halima Jing Yang of China, one of the mosque's newest members, had on her table three pairs of shoes. "My grandma made these by hand, and she is nearly 90 years old," she said proudly, adding, "We just want to spread the message. If we take out the labels, we are far more alike than we are different." One thing everyone inside had in common was a lack of footwear, as keeping dirt out of the house of Allah, God, is a sign of respect. Wearing a floral hijab and leaning down to put on her shoes before leaving, Joy Grieve described herself as an ecumenical Christian and said she couldn't get over how many people were there. "I'm proud of Decatur," she said. Local. Little Theater shows appreciation with mood rings and peace signs by Donette Beckett, H&R staff writer. Sullivan. Tanya Walker met up with a few of her classmates to continue a party they started a year earlier. "We had a class reunion last year and decided we needed to get together as much as possible," said Walker, a 1976 graduate of the Arthur High School. The group of four women met Saturday evening at the Sullivan VFW Hall during the Throwback to the 70s party, sponsored by the Little Theater on the Square. The fundraiser included opportunities to pose for pictures with a cutout of a Volkswagen van, don mood rings, and dance to 70s music. Anne Brewer, 54, attended the event to support the theater. "They do amazing theater and music," she said. Brewer wore a blue polyester dress, similar to one worn during the disco era. She and her husband came to the party because of their love of 70s music and the Little Theater. "My husband and I met in the 70s. We listen to 70s music, we sing it, we dance to it," she said. While the music and atmosphere at the venue were filled with 1970s flair, some of the topics of discussion were pretty heavy. According to Walker and her classmates, the actions of her generation helped pave the way for many women today. They finally let us wear pants when we were in high school, Walker said. You had to wear a dress with shorts underneath, said her friend Andrea Lane. The group also remembered the implementation of Title IX while they were in high school. The law requires high schools to offer equal opportunities for girls, most notably when it came to sports. Before the ruling, schools offered few sports options for girls. Walker remembers her school's administration promoted few alternatives beyond school. During a visit with the guidance counselor, it was suggested that the teen become a nurse. I said, what else could I do? He said, you're cute. Why don't you just want to get married? Walker remembered. I was disgusted. I got married and had kids, but that didn't work either, Lane said. The women now see their experiences as part of a revolutionary change. They saw their class as troublemakers because of their desire for equality and the chance to express themselves. We wanted to do whatever we wanted, Walker said. We could be a nurse, a teacher, or a secretary, said classmate Connie Hopkins. It's nice to say that my kids can go to school and be whatever they want. Earlier in the afternoon, Renee Jackson performed on stage at the Little Theater's show 8-Track, The Sounds of the 70s. Although she is only 24 years old, the singer and dancer understands the importance of the decade and the women who paved the way for her as a performer. The makeup and hair, the shimmering glitter on the glossed lips, the hoop earrings, anything accentuating curves, she said, but also being powerful with the disco divas. Jackson learned about the 1970s through her family. One of her earliest memories was of her father as a disc jockey. She often listened to women with strong voices, such as Chaka Khan, Gloria Gaynor, Donna Summer, and Patti LaBelle. I Will Survive is my go-to karaoke song, Jackson said. The 70s are my favorite decade, because my voice fits it so well. Jackson and the cast of the show attended the party and found it to be an ideal opportunity to meet the audience. It's nice to get out and mingle with the patrons of the theater, she said. We find this fun to do. Songs of the 70s. Longest Time as number one single. You Light Up My Life, Debbie Boone. Night Fever, Bee Gees. Tonight's the Night, Gonna Be All Right, Rod Stewart. Shadow Dancing, Andy Gibb. Most number one singles, Bee Gees, 9. Elton John, 6. Stevie Wonder, 5. Paul McCartney and Wings, 5. Eagles, 5. Top albums by year, 1970, Bridge Over Troubled Water, Simon and Garfunkel. 1971, Jesus Christ Superstar. 1972, Harvest, Neil Young. 1973, The World is a Ghetto, War. 1974, Goodbye, Yellow Brick Road, Elton John. 1975, Elton John's Greatest Hits, Elton John. 1976, Frampton Comes Alive, Peter Frampton. 1977, Rumors, Fleetwood Mac. 1978, Saturday Night Fever. 1979, 52nd Street, Billy Joel. Education. University leaders crave state budget stability, even with cuts. By Lenore Sabata, Lee News Service writer. Normal. With the failure of the so-called grand bargain to resolve Illinois' budget stalemate, higher education officials are expressing concern over what comes next. If the impasse continues, at some point a higher education disaster will occur, Illinois State University President Larry Dietz said Wednesday. Dietz was not specific, but the news has not been good at several schools. Governor State University in Chicago's south suburbs announced Tuesday that it will cut 22 programs and increase tuition 15%. It has already cut 35 degree and certificate programs in the last 2 years. Chicago State University enrolled only 86 freshmen last fall and has seen overall enrollment fall to less than half what it was 6 years ago, with 3,578 students in fall 2016 compared to 7,362 in 2010. An emergency funding measure was needed to funnel a total of $17 million to Chicago State, Western Illinois, and Eastern Illinois universities late last year. Speaking to the Bloomington Pantographs editorial board with several members of the Illinois Coalition to Invest in Higher Education, Dietz said passage of a budget, even one with huge cuts, would represent stability. The worst thing is not knowing. Although ISU remains strong and stable, Dietz said, all of us feel the same frustration about not having a budget. Heartland Community College President Rob Widmer agreed that uncertainty has been the overwhelming problem for us. Randy Dunn, president of the Southern Illinois University System, said paralysis is setting in because of the lack of direction, and it has frozen us in time. Dunn criticized the lack of leadership at the state level, saying the approach seems to be to see who the first one is to not be able to open in the fall. To me, that's a dereliction of duty. Members of the coalition argue that higher education is an economic engine that is producing future employees and entrepreneurs that the state needs for its growth. All schools have been making cuts, trying to protect their core missions and limit impacts on students. Dunn said the failure of the grand bargain means potentially a big second round of reductions that we won't be able to do with cuts around the edges. Dietz and Dunn are among university leaders who testified Tuesday before the Senate Higher Education Committee. Dietz told the committee that instead of asking how long universities can go without a state budget, the question should be, how long can you go before Illinois public universities are severely, perhaps irreparably, damaged? He said, I'm afraid the answer is, that's already happened. Public institutions are not the only ones being affected by the impasse. Illinois Wesleyan University President Eric Jensen told the editorial board a quarter of IWU students receive monetary award program grants, and the percentage is even higher at other private schools. Many institutions have been giving students credit for the state-funded grants so they can enroll, and hoping the state will come through with the money later. One way to increase pressure for action could be for schools to stop covering the cost of MAP grants without state funding. But Dunn said, we're not going to do that to our students and region. We're not going to play that card. Business. Caterpillar's Legal Woes Are Piling Up, by Tony Reed, H&R staff writer. Peoria. Caterpillar Inc.'s tax headaches are becoming a migraine as its legal woes continue to pile up. News broke Wednesday of a federal government-commissioned expert analysis that, according to published reports, concluded the Peoria-based company dodged paying U.S. taxes by funneling money through overseas affiliates using accounting maneuvers that were fraudulent rather than negligent, the report said. Caterpillar did not immediately respond to a request for comment, although a company spokeswoman was quoted earlier as saying the firm had not seen the analysis. Caterpillar has always maintained it did nothing wrong and strongly denied claims it had avoided paying more than $2 billion in taxes. Caterpillar's Peoria headquarters and two other office buildings were raided a week ago by federal agents, including officials from the Internal Revenue Service's Criminal Investigation Unit, who appeared to be searching for documents and computer information. The federal action prompted a shareholder lawsuit filed by a Los Angeles-based firm seeking damages because it claims Caterpillar's share price was compromised by the firm's alleged wrongdoing. Now, the Herald and Review has learned that another shareholder lawsuit seeking damages on similar grounds has been filed on behalf of a shareholder named Jacob Newman and others by Chicago-based law firm Pomerantz LLP. The lawsuit names Caterpillar, current CEO James Umpleby, Chief Financial Officer Bradley M. Halverson, and former CEO Douglas Oberhelman as defendants. They are accused of filing false and misleading reports about the company's health, propping up its bottom line by funneling back billions of dollars in profits from overseas they knew should be subject to U.S. taxes. Pomerantz attorneys further claim that covering up the wrongdoing regarding taxes helped Caterpillar artificially inflate its share price, setting up shareholders to take a bath when the truth was revealed. It seems likely other law firms are set to file suit in similar legal actions that could stretch for years into the future. Seasoned Caterpillar watcher Jim Minton said Caterpillar is having to weather a succession of bad news. It's grappled with a record-breaking 4-year run of down sales, led by the slump in demand for the giant Decatur-built mining trucks. And now come all these legal woes. Caterpillar keeps getting punched, and they keep coming back and recovering, said Minton, a Decatur-based investment advisor with Investment Planners, Inc. But you fear at some point it's all going to catch up with them. Minton stressed he doesn't know the truth or otherwise of the allegations against Caterpillar, but noted the company has been under extreme pressure to find ways to cut expenses. And one of their expenses is taxes. It's hard to know exactly what is going on here, as to whether they crossed the line in how they did things, or if they got bad advice in regard to how to do things, he added. Minton said that however it all shakes out, headlines that mention lawsuits and federal raids don't do much for the Caterpillar customer base. It can make people think twice about buying from Caterpillar if there are some concerns, he added. And I am sure Caterpillar is doing everything it can possibly do in order to soothe those concerns. Caterpillar shares finished Wednesday at $93.23, down $2.70 or 2.81% on the day. Crime and Courts, Howell Guilty of Slashing Decatur Man's Face, by Huey Freeman. Decatur. After deliberating for 1 hour, a jury convicted Robert Howell of one count of aggravated battery with great bodily harm for slashing the face and chest of a 41-year-old man on the city's east side. Howell, 54, a career criminal with 10 prior felony convictions, showed no emotion as he sat at the defense table and heard the verdict at 4:55 p.m. Wednesday, as it was read aloud by the clerk of Associate Macon County Judge James Corio. He was acquitted of one count of Class X armed robbery. Howell, who is being held in jail without bond, will be sentenced by the judge at a hearing on April 13th. The guidelines for the Class 3 felony are 2 to 10 years in prison. The state and defense attorneys agreed that Howell slashed the victim the night of October 4th during a confrontation in the vicinity of Hilton Street and Prairie Avenue. The defense theory was that Howell wielded the knife in self-defense and no robbery ever occurred. In her closing argument, Assistant State's Attorney Jane Foster said the blood trail the victim left from the west side of Hilton to the victim's house on the 600 block of Wood Street showed his version of the incident was accurate. There was no blood found for 371 feet between the residence where the defense said the incident occurred and the site where the police discovered blood spatter on the sidewalk. The trail of evidence leads from 105 North Hilton to the victim's house, Foster said. Ultimately, where it leads is to a guilty verdict for this defendant. Assistant Public Defender Scott Reuter argued that the slashing occurred in a house at the corner of Hilton and Prairie, after the victim reached for a gun while arguing with Howell. Nobody ever saw that gun, and no gun was ever found by police. Jail calls made by Howell to acquaintances before the trial contained messages such as, "Take care of that," expletive. Recordings of the calls were played for the jurors. The jurors acquitted Howell on the armed robbery charge after the victim told the police and court different details of the story. It was unclear whether Howell actually made off with any money, as the victim left the scene after he was stabbed, bleeding profusely from his wounds. The victim testified that he had $602 in his possession when Howell accosted him. Decatur Patrol Officer Ryan Wicks testified that the victim had $540.41 when they found him sitting on the porch of his house, covered with blood, shortly after the incident occurred. After Wicks interviewed him for about 2 minutes while waiting for an ambulance, the victim passed out. Education. Girl Scouts receive grant and nitrogen ice cream from Ameren. By Valerie Wells, H&R staff writer. Decatur. Ice cream made with liquid nitrogen makes a sound very much like thunder as it freezes. And when it's frozen, it looks a little like styrofoam. "It tastes like Dippin' Dots," said Hayden McInerney, a member of Girl Scout Troop 3559, who was chosen to represent Decatur Girl Scouts for a tour of the Joint Information Public Center of Ameren, Illinois, on Wednesday. Girl Scouts of Central Illinois applied for an Ameren Cares grant, which was presented to Jennifer Worth on behalf of the Scouts at the event. Worth said the money will support the organization's outreach program, which allows low-income girls to be Girl Scouts at their schools. Many of those girls would have difficulty with transportation to traditional troop meetings and affording a uniform and fees, and the grant will take care of that for them. "It's for 6 weeks," Worth said. "Of course, we hope that they go home and say, 'Mom and Dad, I want this to be a part of my life,' and stay in scouting and join a traditional troop. We'll make it work, somehow." Daisies are in kindergarten and first grade, while brownies are in second and third grades, and the girls were completing a badge requirement with the visit to Ameren, too. Troop leader Kara Demirjian, Huss, said the STEM badge can be earned by science, technology, engineering, and math activities, or by learning about careers, as they did on Wednesday. Ameren Division Director Gussie Reed welcomed the girls and told them they were celebrating International Women's Day by meeting female engineers who had set up stations throughout the building to provide information on their careers. Emma Ridley, a student at Holy Family School, said some of them are in planning, some in making the plans happen, and some in fixing things that go wrong. Making ice cream was the big hit, however. Heather McConnell Smith, supervising engineer, had brought the ingredients from home and included a presentation on safety gear, from her long sleeves to safety glasses to an apron and steel-toed shoes, just in case she spilled any nitrogen. "They're ugly," she remarked with a chuckle as she put the shoes on, "but it's better to be ugly than to get hurt." That made the little girls laugh, and when she poured the nitrogen from its container and smoke rose from the steel bowl and billowed around her, enveloping the bowl, the table, and that whole end of the room, the reaction from scouts and their moms was noisy. "Oh my God," said one small voice, and McConnell Smith laughed. "Exactly," she said. Local, Mount Zion announces mural for Main Street. By Ryan Voiles, H&R staff writer. Mount Zion. After she saw the murals done by the Decatur Area Arts Council, Becky Hamilton knew she wanted to see something similar in Mount Zion. Hamilton, the administrator for the Mount Zion Chamber of Commerce, will soon get her wish. After several months of discussion, It was announced Wednesday that a mural will be coming to the village in 2018. The news was made official during Wednesday afternoon's meeting of the Mount Zion Chamber. Since 2013, the Decatur Mural Project has led to several prominent murals being painted in high-traffic areas in the downtown area. Those include the Commodore Stephen Decatur mural on the Central Illinois Title Company building, and the History of the Chicago Bears mural on the west side of the building at 111 East Main Street. When I first saw those murals, I thought, what would it take to get one of those here in Mount Zion? The chance arrived in December, when Hamilton and Jerry Johnson, executive director of the Decatur Area Arts Council, discussed the idea of a mural. With Hamilton and village officials interested in getting their own mural, and Johnson saying the council was looking to expand the mural project into the surrounding communities, it did not take long for an agreement. Since several locations in Decatur have already been identified for murals in 2017, officials agreed to move the target for Mount Zion's to 2018. What is yet to be determined is a final design or location for the mural. Johnson said the goals for the project have been to find building locations, sponsors, and artists to make the mural a reality. One part of that is solved, as the Village of Mount Zion, its Chamber of Commerce, and the Odd Fellows Lodge 300 of Mount Zion are partnering on the project. Hamilton said they're eyeing a location on Main Street for its high traffic. The groups are talking with local businesses to finalize a place for the mural, and its final design will be chosen from artists' submissions. Those submissions will likely take place next spring, Johnson said. Tentative completion of the project is next summer. The council is currently accepting artist submissions for its three projects lined up for this year, which includes placing a mural at the 100 block of North Oakland Avenue outside of Garcia's Pizza, 200 block West Main Street to replace the current pot and bamboo mural, and 730 East Sirigordo Street, east wall of Ken's Aquarium and Pet Supply. Submissions must be in by March 31st. For more information, visit www.decaturarts.org/murals. Decatur World Kidney Day. Decatur Memorial Hospital will host a free educational seminar from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. today for World Kidney Day in the DMH classrooms. Pediatric kidney specialist Nazia Kulsum-Mechi from SIU Medicine will be this year's featured guest speaker. Kidney specialists Mohammed Dawood, Mohammed Hasnain, and M. Mustansar Qureshi from the DMH Medical Group will also be on hand at the event. Refreshments will be served and seating is limited. Please call 217-876-2850 to register or visit dmhcares.com/events. Decatur School Superintendent. The Decatur School Board has begun interviewing candidates for the district superintendent job. The board expects to be able to adhere to the original timeline of naming a new superintendent at the Tuesday, March 28th board meeting. The search firm of Hazard, Young, Attia & Associates had told the board at the beginning of the search that they expected to provide several candidates by February 28th for the board to be able to conduct interviews and make a decision at its final March meeting. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half of the Herald & Review for Thursday, March 9th, 2017. Please stay tuned.